Okay, so our speaker today is Yedrzej Swiszewski, who's going to speak about developments from the radial gauge.
Hello, everyone. I hope you can hear me. So indeed, I'll talk about the latest developments on the radial gauge. Let me first thank the organizers for giving me the opportunity to present my talk. I should say that the results I will present were obtained in collaborations with Norbert Barendorfer, Paweł Duch, Wojtek Kamiński, and Professor Lewandowski, and they contributed to different parts of that, and you will see to which by the references I'll give during my talk. So let us go to slide number 2, in which I will present the plan of my talk. So I'll start by giving you an introduction in which I hope to tell you something about what the radial gauge is, and also I'll mention a construction of observables, so-called observables, which really underlines this whole construction of the radial gauge, and it allows us to have the intuitions of what is really going on there. Next, I will also present or shortly advertise an application of this radial gauge, which I find interesting and perhaps also important. And then I will switch to the main topic of today's talk, which will be the space-time radial gauge, which is a slight generalization of the radial gauge. And I will tell you who is interested in that. And it turns out that recently people doing or working in the context of ADS-CFT correspondence were employing a very similar construction or basically space-time radial gauge. And then I will explain why they use it and what for, and also what can we tell them from basing on our knowledge of it. And then I will shortly wrap up with some conclusions. So let us go to slide number 3, which is divided into two parts. There is the top half and the bottom half. And in the top half, you see this observables construction. So the background or the place we are working in is canonical general relativity. And I am trying to what I will describe is a construction of observables for this theory, which are invariant under spatial diffeomorphisms. The way we construct them is that we take this blue spatial slice, which you see in the picture, and then we introduce a structure which represents the observer. So it's basically we are selecting a point, and then we are picking a reference frame, or what I mean is we pick a basis in the tangent space at this one point, which parameterizes with which we can parameterize this tangent space, and then using the exponential map, for example, we can map this this tangent space to the manifold and obtain coordinates on this spatial slice. Now those coordinates are represented by the yellow lines, which I hope are visible for you, and then you can see that there are those radial lines, which are radial geodesics by construction, and one of the coordinates is the radial parameter or the proper distance along those geodesics, and those geodesics will play a crucial role in my whole talk. And then there are also those roundish shapes, which are really surfaces of constant radial distance from this observer. They will also be important, and I should say that although we can work in we can generalize it to higher dimensions. My talk will be concerned with 3 spatial dimensions and the fourth, 4 space-time dimensions, if you want. Now, if we have those coordinates, then we can define observables as pullbacks of canonical fields living on that spatial on that Cauchy surface, the hyper surface into a parameter space, right? So we basically express fields in those coordinates, and that is precisely an example of the so-called relational observables framework. And then our observables are invariant under spatial diffeomorphisms. Now, of course, there are many different constructions which are very similar to that. You can define geometric coordinates in many ways and then construct observables like that. The problem usually is that their dependence on the canonical data is very complicated. And therefore, you don't have a good control on their Poisson algebra, if you know the Poisson algebra at all. With our observers' observables, a key feature of them is that we actually know their Poisson algebra. So we are able to compute their variations and therefore also their Poisson brackets. And this is the content of the paper which I cite at the bottom of the upper half of my slide. Now, equivalently, or let's say there is a dual description of this construction, which is not in terms of observables, but in terms of a certain gauge, which we call the radial gauge. And this is the content of the lower half of my slide. So what you do there, or in this approach, you would say that the spatial metric, QAB, small Latin indices, will run through three values, so all the spatial directions. This metric has to have the form given in point number one. So the radial-radial component of this metric has to be one, and the radial-angular components are fixed to be zero. The angular-angular components, called QAB with capital AB, capital Latin indices will run through the angular indices, so you can think of them as theta phi if you want. They coordinatize the surfaces of constant radial distance. Now this QAB is the free part of the metric after left after the gauge fixing. If you impose such a gauge, this gauge fixing fixes the spatial diffeomorphism freedom. Then you can compute the Dirac bracket or the Dirac algebra. And this is done in point number two, or the results are highlighted in point number two. And you see that some part of this algebra, so namely the part which concerns the gravitational metric, the spatial metric, QAB, and its momentum, the components which are also angular, they have canonical Poisson brackets. This is represented by the three deltas. If you have also some matter fields, they will also, their brackets also won't be affected by this gauge fixing, and this is represented by the delta. And then also the cross terms between the matter fields and the gravitational fields, if you consider the angular components of the gravitational fields, you also find that the Poisson structure the structure of the algebra is canonical, so all the Dirac brackets are zero. Now the non-trivial part. Okay.
So because you are partially gauge fixing, I guess some of your diffeomorphism constraints are now second class from the point of view of the algebra. So when you say the Dirac bracket is because you are really computing the second class, you're eliminating the second class part of the algebra from the Poisson bracket. Is that what you are doing in order to compute these brackets?
So these brackets are the Dirac brackets, which are which I obtain after partial gauge fixing. So if you want, if you start in your initial theory, you have the scalar constraint and the vector constraint. What I'm concerned at this slide with is just fixing the vector constraint. So this gauge fixing in point number one is there to fix the vector constraint. So when I'm in point number two, and I'm those brackets are the Dirac brackets. And if you want, in this Dirac matrix, which I'm inverting, I'm taking the vector constraint and this gauge condition spelled out in point one. Does this answer your question?
Right, so now in your algebra, you have some first class and some second class, right? You have still two first class diffeomorphic constraints and one first class Hamiltonian. Is that the way it is? And you have only one second class diffeomorphism constraint, which is second class with the gauge fixing condition.
Yes,
what is your algebra constraint now in this gauge, in the setup you're going to work with, in which you say that you have this Dirac bracket?
So the number of, I'm not sure why I fully understand what you're asking about. So the number of conditions I'm imposing is three, right? If you look at point number one, there is radial-radial fixed to one, radial-angular fixed to zero, and the other radial angular fixed to zero. So there are three conditions for three, let's say, independent generators of spatial diffeomorphisms. So I am fixing the spatial diffeomorphisms entirely.
All three of them. Thank you. Yes, I understood now. All three of the spatial diffeomorphisms are being fixed now.
Oh, yes. Okay, yes. So the number of conditions is three, as you can see from point number one, maybe not so clearly. Right, so... So the non-trivial part of the algebra is covered in the last line of point number two. So if you look at the gravitational momentum conjugate to the gauge fixing conditions, so to the metric components which I am gauge fixing, QR small a, then you will find that the Poisson brackets are, or sorry, the Dirac brackets are non-trivial. In fact, they will not just be non-zero, but they will also be non-local. However, remarkably, we can still compute them, and this computation is, of course, it's a dual picture to the observables construction. So if we knew the algebra from in the top half of my slide, then here it follows directly what those brackets should be. Now, the point is that in point number three, so when we want to impose a gauge condition, some certain gauge fixing, what we do is we first introduce this gauge fixing to limit, let's say, n, in this case, 3 degrees of freedom to fix them. And then we fix another three, or we solve for another 3 degrees of freedom from the constraints that we fixed. So we can now solve the vector constraint for exactly those PRAs, as it is said in point number three. And of course, if we do that, then those expressions for PRA will be non-local. However, when we plug them into the Hamiltonian, we obtain a Hamiltonian which governs the evolution of the gauge fixed theory. So now notice that in this gauge fixed theory, the degrees of freedom which we have are the angular components of the spatial metric and the momentum, and also matter fields in case you want to consider a model in which there is some matter. And there is no non-localities in the algebra. So the Dirac algebra in that reduced or the gauge fixed theory is canonical. The non-locality or the non-triviality is pushed entirely to the Hamiltonian. So indeed, the dynamics will be very non-trivial. However, the kinematics, at least, of your theory is simple. And that is good, for example, if you want to consider some canonical quantizations. Now, I should say that this radial gauge picture was described in this paper, which is cited at the bottom of my slide. And on slide number four, I would like to show you a certain application of that reduced or the gauge fixed theory, which I just described. So let us first look at the blue part of this diagram in the picture. So how do we treat spherical symmetry in the context of loop quantum gravity? Well, it's hard to find the spherically symmetric sector of full loop quantum gravity. So the strategy which is usually employed is that you look at the top left corner of this diagram at general relativity. Then you symmetry reduce going down to Mie superspace models, so spherically symmetric Mie superspace models, and then you quantize using loop techniques, obtaining quantum spherically symmetric Mie superspace models. And in these models, you can there have been recently many papers with interesting physical results, I would say, about in computed in this theory. Now a question which is evident is that we should be able to at least indicate that those quantum Mie superspace models really come from the full quantum theory in some sense. So we should be able to draw this this dashed line in this diagram. And an idea to do that is to use exactly the radial gauge, which I described before. So now we go to this yellowish part of that diagram. So the idea is the following. It's a certain scheme of defining symmetry reduction. So how do you do that? Well, you take full general relativity and you make a small sidestep, which is this, you fix a particular gauge, which is tailored to your problem. In the case of spherical symmetry, it will be the radial gauge. So you fix your gauge and you end up with the theory which I talked about before, and which is represented by those roundish surfaces of constant radial distance. There is the central point representing the location of the observer. There is some, and the geometry is parametrized by the metrics of those surfaces. There is actually a one parameter where the radial distance is the parameter, family of those two geometries describing the internal geometries of those surfaces. They also have their momenta. And there might be some matter fields in case you want to consider a matter model. Now, you take this theory, you quantize it using loop techniques. So you basically adapt the standard loop techniques to the variables you're having in your classical theory. And then you obtain a quantum theory, which I won't tell you about many. I mean, I won't tell you about many details of it. But the crucial thing is that in the Hilbert space you're obtaining, you can identify naturally rotations. And then if you have or those transformations with which you want to with which you want to be invariant in order to say that, that you have spherical symmetry. So basically there are natural ways of defining spherical symmetry in that quantum theory. And notice that I didn't do on the classical level any sort of symmetry reduction. I just fixed some gauge, not restricting the physical degrees of freedom, and then I quantize it, and on the quantum level, I'm imposing the symmetry reduction by demanding some invariance. And now it turns out that I can go down to, so symmetry reduced, by that I mean go along those yellow arrows to the MIDI superspace models. However, I can also do it in a less restrictive way, obtaining theories which have more degrees of freedom than the MIDI superspace models. And now, of course, the question which comes around is whether we can, I mean, what can we say about the results which were obtained in the MIDI superspace models? Are they changed by those additional degrees of freedom? Or maybe if not, then it will set a better foundation for the results obtained in the MIDI superspace models. Now, I should say that this scheme, which I described of defining symmetry reduction in loop quantum gravity, was described in the paper which is cited on the bottom of the slide. But the scheme, so I should say that the application of to spherical symmetry, especially the dynamics of it, is to a large extent a work in progress. So I won't tell you more about it today. However, this very scheme can be also applied in the cosmological context, and this you will learn more from Norbert's talk in 4 weeks, I believe. So I encourage you to attend his talk. And now I should also say that the point of this slide is that I want to underline that this radial gauge is a thing which seems to be very useful, and this is one of the applications that you can use it for. Now, let us switch gears and go to the main part of my talk, and this is described on slide number 5. So this slide is divided into left and right part, as you can see. And on the left part, I again tell you what the radial gauge construction is, or I just rephrase differently this radial gauge fixing. So how can we impose this radial gauge? Well, you can look at it in the following way. You have a certain system of coordinates, which is basically you have this point and some radial lines. And now you want to impose a condition, or you want to demand that those radial lines are spatial geodesics. Now, this means that certain components of the Christoffel symbols have to vanish, right? So you see that these are the ones which have double radial lower index, and all three of them, so this A runs through three values, have to be zero. Now, this three above the Christoffel symbol, of course, refers to the fact that it's the spatial metric which is involved in this connection. Now, you can translate this condition into the, you can express those components of the Christoffel symbols with the use of the spatial metric. And you see that in the middle of the left-hand side of my slide. And now, imposing that this guy has to vanish gives you the condition, or you can solve this condition with QRA equal to delta RA, so exactly the three gauge conditions which I considered before. Now, to be 100% precise, I should say that that actually this condition in the middle of the slide is a bit strong. Actually they're not entirely equivalent, but the point is that if you demand that your gauge fixing is the same in each direction, so basically you want QRR to be independent of the angles, which is an obvious requirement, which is like an requirement which is, which is natural, I would say, then you're ending up with the conditions which I spelled at the bottom of at the left-hand side. So QRA equal to delta RA. Now, a generalization like one can think of this construction is presented on the right-hand side. So you again start with some radial lines reaching from the observer, but now you want them not to be spatial geodesics, but space-time geodesics, which boils down to the fact that radial components of the Christoffel symbols have to be zero. However, now these are Christoffel symbols of the four geometry, so of the space-time metric. Now, since we want to employ the space-time radial gauge in the canonical context, we express this Christoffel symbols with the use of internal and external geometry of the surfaces within which those radial lines lie. And the expressions are given in the middle of the right-hand side of my slide. And you find that the temporal component of the involved Christoffel symbols is proportional to the radial-radial component of the extrinsic curvature. Now, in the spatial components, you see that there is a term proportional to the extrinsic curvature, and there is the term which we recognize from the spatial radial gauge case. This, of course, means that if we want to impose the condition which I wrote in the first line, that the radial lines are spacetime geodesics, it means that we need to copy the conditions we had before and add the condition that the radial-radial components of the extrinsic curvature are zero. So now instead of three conditions, we have four conditions. And of course, the advantage of that construction on the right-hand side is that we knew that with the first three conditions on the metric, we can fix the vector constraint. Now we could use the fourth one to deal with the Hamiltonian constraint. And in this way, we will deparametrize all the space-time diffeomorphisms in a more uniform way, so to speak, so in a geometrical way. And this might be advantageous in some applications. And now it turns out that indeed there are some applications, and these are, I hope, to describe on slide number 6. So it turned out that recently, people studying ADS-CFT correspondence were interested in similar constructions. They sometimes call it differently. There are many different names. I listed them at the top of my slide. So there's holographic gauge, axial gauge, Pfefferman-Graham, sometimes also space-time normal coordinates or space-time Gaussian normal coordinates. There are many different names, but the construction is very similar. So So in ADS-CFT, you have this anti-de-Sitter spacetime in the bulk, and then on its boundary, there is some conformal theory, and you want to construct observables in the bulk by taking spacetime geodesics reaching from this boundary inside. And then you measure proper distance along those geodesics, and that gives you the spacetime radial gauge. Now, Why are those people interested in such observables? Well, I should say that I'm no expert on ADS-CFT, but just highlighting what I think the reason is the following. So if you look at this correspondence in the so-called boundary perspective, then your goal is to construct operators in this quantum field, in this conformal field theory, living on the boundary, which will represent the physics in the bulk, so in this anti-de-Sitter spacetime. Now, the problem is that if you have this dictionary, so-called, so a way of translating results from the boundary to the bulk, then you need to know what is the gauge that the results in the bulk are in. So imagine that you were able to obtain some interesting calculations in you performed some interesting calculation in the conformal field theory, and now you want to understand what it tells you about this ADS. You need to know in which gauge this result is expressed. So you basically need to somehow get rid of or face the problem of gauge redundancy in the bulk. And now, one of the reasons, one of the properties of those dictionaries, which is desired by people studying this correspondence, is the so-called microlocality. Or basically what they want is that the matter fields, at least, which live in this anti-de-Sitter spacetime, will be commuting at space-like separations. And now a question which they pose is, okay, so we want to consider this spacetime radial gauge because it makes this dictionary as simple as possible. And now the question is, are the matter fields really commuting in this gauge? And it turns out that the community gave mixed answers. So there is a paper from last year authored by Kabat and Lifshitz, in which the authors claim that the matter fields are indeed commuting. And I can tell you, so what they do is they identify the space-time radial gauge conditions, they describe what you have to do to compute their the brackets in the gauge-fixed theory, but then they say that it's too complicated and therefore they won't do that. And instead they give some general argument with which they argue that that the matter fields do commute. I can tell you more about the details of their argument if you want, maybe in the questions, but the point is that that they argue that the matter fields are indeed commuting. Well, recently, as you can see, there was another paper by Donnelly and Giddings in which they considered, among other gauges, also space-time radial gauge, and they argued that the previous result was wrong and that physical fields or matter fields are not commuting at space-like separations. And their results were perturbative, obtained only perturbatively. So they argued that in the first perturbative order, the matter fields are not commuting. And when we looked at those papers, we realized that using the machinery we had at hand, because we studied this radial gauge, we can actually just straightforwardly answer the question explicitly computing the Dirac bracket. And this is what I hope to describe in my next slide. So in slide number
Can I ask a question? So what is your conclusion? I mean, you gave us two arguments, but you have done this analysis, you have fixed this gauge, you have a very systematic way of doing things. So do you agree that they commute or do you agree that they do not commute at space like surface?
So as I will show you, the matter fields are certainly not commuting. So the result which Donnelly and Giddings obtained is right. They obtained it to the first order. We obtained the full result, and it agrees with reference number 2, but it disagrees with reference number 1. And
thank you very much.
Okay.
Sorry. So this disagreement implies that reference 1 is wrong, or that there were different choices made?
No, the choice is the same, really. In reference number 1, they get to the point in which they are supposed to read off the algebra structure, and they say that it's too hard, they won't do that, and they give some, let's say, physical argument, or, well, more involved argument, and I think that this argument is wrong, and there is a certain point in which I think this argument is wrong, and we described that in a paper which I will reference on the next slide, so so you can find it there. I can also tell you more about it if you want. But yes, so the point is that they don't compute the Dirac bracket. They use some walk around and they get lost on the way. So if you go to slide number 7, then let me fix the notation. So what I will be working with is Hamiltonian and vector constraints, and they are spelled out at the top top of my slide. So you see that in the Hamiltonian constraint there is a gravitational part, in which there is the coupling constant kappa, which is just 8 pi times g newton, which I will mention also later. And there is some matter contribution. So since I want to compute the matter brackets, I want to have some matter in my theory, the only thing I assume is that it's minimally coupled. And it contains some scalar field. Now, in vector constraint, there is, of course, the gravitational part and some part coming from this scalar field phi. So in point number 1, you see that the constraints I'm having are now 8 constraints. They are collectively denoted with this fracture C, and alpha runs through 8 values. So the first is the Hamiltonian constraint H. There is the radial component of the vector constraint CR. There are the 2 angular components of the vector constraint CA. So A, if you want, labels theta and phi. And these are the four constraints which are the initial constraints, if you want. And then I impose additional 4 constraints fixing the space-time radial gauge. So they are the ones which I spelled before. KRR has to be 0, QRR has to be 1, and QRA have to be 0, both of them. So now these are the constraints, and now I'm introducing the Dirac bracket with respect to those second-class constraints. Of course, I have to check that they are second-class, but they are. Now, at point number 2, I give the definition of the Dirac bracket. Of course, if you want to compute the Dirac bracket of 2 observables, and by that I mean just functionals on the phase space, O1 and O2, you have to compute their Poisson bracket and then subtract this this additional term, which involves, on one hand, Poisson brackets of the observables with each of the constraints, and then there is this intertwining term, which is m to minus 1, and that is the inverse of the Dirac matrix. Now, I should say that in case we would be considering some finite dimensional theory, this would just be the sum. However, since we are dealing with a field theory here, there are also some integrals involved here. So this m to minus 1 is really an operator acting on both sides. Now, how is this m defined? Well, it's the Dirac matrix. So it, in point number 3, you see that it's just given by the Poisson brackets of each of the constraints with the other constraints. Each pair of the constraints gives you one entry of the Dirac matrix. And this Dirac matrix is given here explicitly. Well, you see that there are zeros on the diagonal because obviously there is this whole beast is antisymmetric. And then since it is antisymmetric, the part below the diagonal is it's specified by its value above the diagonal. So I just displayed the interesting part. Now we can also notice that this whole thing is proportional to a delta, and that is because all the constraints we are considering are local, so their value at a certain point of the manifold or of the spatial manifold depends only on the values of canonical fields in that point. But since in our initial constraints there are some derivatives involved, therefore in the Dirac matrix you also obtain some derivatives, as you can see, acting on those deltas. Now, for completeness, I also...
One question, very quick. Just to come back to my previous question. So now you can explicitly tell us which constraints have remained the first class. I find it a bit hard to read because the matrix is 6 by 6 instead of 8 by 8. There are some indices that are fluctuating. So can you just tell us in words, is the Hamiltonian remaining first class?
Yes. What okay. Else? So in the radial gauge, spatial radial gauge, I imposed 3 conditions, and I fixed the 3 spatial diffeomorphisms. The Hamiltonian remained first class, if you want. Now, in the case I'm discussing now is the space-time radial gauge, in which I have 4 gauge conditions, and I'm fixing all 4 diffeomorphism constraints, both the Hamiltonian constraint and all 3 of the vector constraints. So all of the constraints are second class, and I'm solving all the diffeomorphism freedom in my theory. Now, indeed, this matrix is 6 by 6, exactly for the same reason for which in point number 1, although there are 8 constraints, you only see 6 of them listed. Because this capital A denotes both of the angular components. So basically, it's just the same. So not to write twice the same thing, I'm collectively denoting it as A. If you want to look at the matrix, then the last column has a free index. Oh, it changes from A to B. I'm sorry for that. But the point is that in the last column, there are really 2 columns. And then in the third row, there are also, in reality, 2 rows. Now, the point is so is that clear, or should I say something more? Okay, so there is in this matrix, you also see that there's this term T-mat, which is, of course, the matter contribution. I'm just, in point number 4, I'm just spelling out how it is computed from the matter contribution to the Hamiltonian constraint, but that won't be important for us later, so I'm just writing here this for completeness. Now, it would seem that we are almost there, but the problem is that in the Dirac matrix, you want to have m to minus 1, and what I wrote here is just the m. So these are really just the Poisson brackets of all the constraints with each other. Now, to be able to obtain the Dirac bracket, I need to invert this matrix. And as you can see, this is a differential operator of second order in some parts, and it will be complicated. But the remarkable thing, or the thing which allowed us to tell the people in ADS-CFT correspondence what the result should be, is that we were able to actually invert this matrix. And let me go to slide number 8, in which I will pinpoint some features of that matrix first. So if you look at the top of slide number 8, you'll see that I highlighted the initial constraints, so the Hamiltonian and vector constraints with the blue color, and then the gauge fixing constraints with red color. Now, in point number 1, I just rewrote this Dirac matrix, And the blue block of that matrix is the part coming from Poisson brackets of initial constraints with initial constraints. So this is basically just the Dirac algebra. And since Dirac, we know that the Dirac algebra closes on the constraint surface, and this is what I'm interested in. So in this Dirac matrix, the first block is just a 4x4 matrix of zeros. Now, in the bottom right corner of this matrix, there is the red block, which comes from Dirac Poisson brackets of the gauge fixing constraints with themselves. And in this block will be very important later, so that's why I'm spending time on discussing it here. And you can see that in this block there is some non-zero entry. And if you look at the constraints, it's quite straightforward where it comes from. So I have the metric conditions, so the gauge conditions just on the spatial metric, which are obviously commuting with each other, Poisson commuting. However, this fourth condition, which I added, this KRR, is not Poisson commuting with one of them. It's since KRR involves PRR, so the moment radial-radial component of the gravitational momentum, it does not Poisson commute with QRR. And the Poisson bracket is given by this kappa over square root of determinant of G. So you see that there are some non-trivial entries into that block, which I will also call this red block with letter G, which you can see at the right-hand side of equation in point number one. Now the remaining block is the purple one, and the purple one, of course, comes from mixing the blue with the red. So these are Poisson brackets of the initial constraints with the gauge fixing constraints. And of course, we know that if this is a proper gauge fixing, then this is the block which has to be invertible, right? So if the gauge fixing constraints are really supposed to gauge fix the initial constraints, then the red block has to be invertible. Now, I denote it with an F, and then you can see that in the bottom left corner of my Dirac matrix, there is minus F transposed. So this T in the upper index denotes the formal transposition of a block. Now, in point number two, I write an identity that if you have a matrix of this form and you want to invert it, then the inverse is given by the inverses of the blocks in the combination spelled out in point number two. So you see that there is this top left corner in which there is F to minus 1 transposed G and F to minus 1. Now, if you look at this inverse, you see that, before that, I want to say that this right-hand side of equation 2 is exactly what enters the Dirac bracket, right? This is really the expression which we need to plug there to be able to compute Dirac brackets. Now, the thing which we need to still to compute is this F to minus 1. So we need to invert this purple block. So in point number 3, I'm rewriting what we need to do. We need to solve a system of partial differential equations, which is constructed in the following way. You act with an F on a collection of four fields N. They have four indices beta. And then you obtain some functions M. Now, assuming that M functions are known, you need to find the N functions which correspond to them, solving this system of equations. So in point number 4, I spell those equations explicitly, and you can see that the last equation are really two equations, right? The A has two values, so these are really four equations for four fields. And now, again, maybe quite surprisingly, we can solve this system of equations. And I won't go into full details about that, but let me just point the key features on slide number 9. So in slide number 9, at the top, you see again those four equations, which appear as three. And then if you first follow the green arrow, then you can see that what happens there is you just integrate radially this fourth equation. And on the left-hand side, you obtain the two unknown functions, Na and N. On the right-hand side, you obtain some radial integral of a known function, Ma. Now, from this, you you obtain Na, so you basically solve this equation for Na, and you plug it into the first of the equations which need to be solved. And then you see that on the left-hand side, you have second derivative of N, a term proportional to N, a term, again, proportional to N coming from the equation I just obtained. And on the right-hand side, I have some expressions in terms of the known fields. So again, this is a partial differential equation, but just in one variable, really, only in the radial variable. So when solving it, I obtain N as a function of the known fields M. This I display with the square brackets. And this is obtained as some radial derivatives, radial integrals of the known functions, and some combinations of them. Now, having N, I plug it back using the purple arrow into the equation I obtained previously, and from that I read off the NA components in terms of the known functions. Having NA, I can plug it into the second equation, and using the following the red line, I obtain the radial component of this unknown field N in terms of the known fields M, again, just by a radial integral of that equation. So following the thick arrow, you see that what I obtained is really the four fields N as functions of the known fields M. So what I did in this radial integrals and substituting solutions of some equations onto the others, I really constructed step by step the inverse of that differential operator F. And this inverse is called with those as N with those square brackets specifying the known functions for which I invert my operator. Now, having this F, I can plug it into my Dirac bracket. So let's do that on slide number 10. And you see on this slide that, again, I spell out the constraints I'm having. And point number one, I just recall the definition of the Dirac bracket. And indeed, you see that there are those F to minus ones. So if you want to now to answer the question posed by the ADS CFT community, then you should what I do is I just take two scalar fields located at some points, r1 theta 1 and r2 theta 2, where r is the radial distance and thetas are the angles, and then I want to use my formula. Now, if you if you follow the formula in point number one, then of course the Poisson bracket of two scalar fields is zero, and you're left with the terms coming from this from this sum. Now notice that there are Poisson brackets of my observables, so my field phi, with each of the constraints. Now since my gauge fixing constraints, so the red constraints from the top of my slide, are purely geometrical, so they only involve the metric and the momentum, the gravitational momentum. Therefore, my phi fields, or all the matter fields, in fact, Poisson commute with the gauge fixing constraints. Therefore, the Poisson brackets in formula on the right hand side of point one will be non-zero only if I take Poisson brackets of matter fields with the initial constraints, with the blue constraints. So if you want, the C alphas need to be the initial constraints, and so do the C betas. But that means that out of this block matrix, only the top left corner or top left block contributes. All the other will not contribute because at least one of the Poisson brackets will be zero. Now, in this top left corner, you see that there is F to minus 1 on the right-hand side, which acts on this result of the Poisson bracket of my field phi with the initial constraints. And then I just plug the result of that Poisson bracket into the solutions I obtained on the previous slide, and I know what F to minus 1 does with it. Now, F to minus 1 transposed does analogous thing to the Poisson bracket on the left, this transposition switches the action of it so that it acts on the left. And I'm left with this G block, which just acts by multiplication. It didn't contain any differentials. It just had this kappa over square root of determinant. So as you can see, in point number two, the result of this Dirac bracket is just two terms, in fact. in which there are some n fields. Those n fields are the ones obtained as some radial integrals of the results of the Poisson brackets. And there is this kappa term in the middle. Now, this leads to the following conclusions. So, firstly, in space-time radial gauge, matter fields clearly do not commute. So you might think that, well, maybe those n fields are in some sense vanishing, but they cannot be, because these are inverses of this block F, and this gauge fixing is a proper gauge fixing. So, if you want to talk about Dirac brackets, they have to be proper gauge fixing. Therefore, this F has to be invertible. Therefore, the action of this inverse has to be non-trivial. And so you see that the matter fields do not commute. Now, secondly, the results are non-local. And that you don't see from what I showed you, but you have to trust me that since, as I said, there are just the radial integrals involved in solving those equations from the previous slide, therefore, it turns out that the Dirac bracket of two matter fields is canonical if the angles are different. If theta 1 is different from theta 2, the Dirac brackets will be zero. However, if they are not, if they point at the same in the same direction, meaning that the two points lie on the same radial geodesic, then the result will be non-zero, and in fact, it will have support along this radial line. Now, the question of which part of that radial line the support will be is actually more subtle, and it depends on the precise way in which you invert or in which you solve the equations which I presented in the previous slide, and that is linked to the precise construction you're considering. So if you want to think about the construction coming from a sort of observables construction which I started my talk with, then you will solve those equations integrating from zero, and then there will be some parts, some specific parts of that radial geodesics which will give support to the non-localities in the Dirac bracket. If you consider the ADS-CFT type of construction in which you integrate from or you fix the values of your fields at infinity, then a different part of that geodesic will contribute. But still, there is always some part which contributes and gives you this non-locality in the Dirac bracket. Now, a third conclusion is that you see that this non-locality is proportional to the kappa, to the gravitational coupling constant. And since it is proportional to G Newton, therefore, in the weak gravity limit, which is also for interest in ADS-CFT because they want to consider some perturbations around no gravity, let's say, then indeed we reproduce the results, the result obtained by Donnelly and Giddings, that in if G Newton goes to zero, then this non-localities also vanish. And now I would also like to draw a more general conclusion. So if you go through... So the way I presented what I said, it seems maybe a bit of obvious that this non-locality appears. I mean, I imposed some gauge conditions, I computed some Dirac bracket and obtained some non-localities. Well, in some sense, it is a bit surprising because notice that the initial constraints are the gravitational diffeomorphism constraints. Now, you impose purely geometrical conditions, right? The red conditions, the extrinsic curvature, the spatial metric, these are purely geometrical conditions. They don't fix the matter content in any way. And now what I'm telling you is that the matter sector of the algebra is changed. So the Poisson, the Dirac bracket of the matter fields are even of two fields, not even on the Dirac bracket between the field and its momentum. It's already somehow modified. And if you look closely, then you can identify why this happens, because it didn't really have to happen, I think. So if you look at the formula given in point number one, then you see that in general, if you have geometric conditions, geometric gauge fixing conditions, then again, those Poisson brackets involved in that formula will vanish for if you consider your observables to be from the matter sector. However, there is this top left block, which might give you non-trivial answers. And this this happens when there is this G term. So we know that Fs are non-zero, and therefore this G is really what controls whether your Dirac brackets are canonical or not in the matter sector. So in my case, in the case of space-time radial gauge, the additional gauge fixing constraints, which I added, were not mutually commuting, and therefore this G was not zero. If it was zero, then also this term would vanish, and then the Dirac bracket of at least the matter sector would be still canonical. And that is what Kabat and Lifshitz expected when they addressed the space-time radial gauge. However, you see that it is the non-commutation or the fact that the gauge fixing conditions are not commuting among each other, which produces additional terms in the Dirac bracket and makes it non-canonical. So this is a somewhat more general conclusion from or lesson we can learn from investigating this particular gauge. And now let me go to my last slide, which is slide number 11, in which I would like to conclude. So I started my talk by presenting this construction of observables, and also advertising a dual description of it, which is called the radial gauge. And I hope to advocate that it is a useful tool of deparametrizing the spatial diffeomorphisms in canonical general relativity. And I also mentioned that it leads to an interesting definition of spherical symmetry on the quantum level, for example, in the context of loop quantum gravity. And again, I advertised the talk of Norbert, which will be in 4 weeks from now, which will tell you more about symmetry reduction schemes in loop quantum gravity, or employing similar schemes in this context. And then I switched to the space-time radial gauge, which is in particular of interest for ADS-CFT correspondence. I showed you that it has non-local Dirac brackets, also in the matter sector. And I, moreover, gave you this more general remark that if you want to geometrically gauge fix diffeomorphisms in your canonical generally relativistic theory, then you better, if you want your matter sector to be to retain its canonical algebra, then you should better take gauge fixing constraints which are mutually commuting. And that is all I wanted to tell you today. Thank you.
Questions?
Okay, so can I ask, first of all, thank you very much for this very clear, beautiful talk. So I have several questions. I think the answers are going to be short, so let me start. The first is that on slide 10,
yes,
the key equation is equation 2, and I mean, you alluded something to these n's, right? Those n's are obtained by solving the partial differential equations of the previous slide.
Yes.
So is this something that you have an explicit formula for, or there are probably just some implicit integrals of something?
Mm-hmm.
So do you have explicit formulas for the end? That's your question.
Okay, so if you go to slide number 9 and look at the equations you have
right.
to solve, then the second equation...
Right.
So the second equation is just a partial differential equation. You solve it by integrating it radially, so you have an explicit solution. The fourth one, or the third and fourth one, is also just integrated radially. So you have an explicit solution. The only problem is with the first equation, because it is, again, just radial equation, and just radial derivatives are there, but it's second order. So the solution we give, we understand this solution, but the solution is given by an ordered exponential. It is explicit to the extent to which an ordered exponential is explicit.
Right. Okay, so thank you. The second question was, I mean, you mentioned about the Hamiltonian constraint. And the Hamiltonian constraint is also presumably non-local, right?
In this spatial radial gauge, the Hamiltonian constraint...
In this part of the talk, you have just made the Hamiltonian constraint disappear because... This is then the total gauge fixing of all the constraints.
Yes.
But in the very first part of the talk, you were talking about just putting the spatial radial gauge and then getting rid of the
and then
the dimorphism.
Then the Hamiltonian is non-local.
And then still being less with the Hamiltonian constraint.
Yes, so in the spatial case, the Hamiltonian is non-local.
It is not. The third question is about the, have any of you thought about possibly doing this in a covariant phase-space formulation, which might be more perhaps amenable to some issues in ADHD or other issues? I suspect that that is going to be rather difficult because in here, you sort of have to solve this algebra and so on the canonical phase space. Whereas in the other case, you have to do it in the space of linearized solutions to the equations. And so it might be very difficult. I just want to know if your impression is the same or maybe you already done a lot of work and you know the answer. The question is, have you thought about doing some gauge fixing like that in the context of covariant phase space framework?
Yeah, so let me answer it in give two answers to that. So firstly, if you look at this construction covariantly, then if you start from spacetime and you have a point and you shoot those radial geodesics, now you demand that those geodesics are spacetime geodesics, so you're fully covariant. But now if you look at all geodesics, which are what I want to say in this answer is that you have sort of natural way of defining those spatial slices in the covariant, even in the covariant picture. So if you have this observer, then in the covariant picture is a world line. You have the vector tangent to this observer. You have vectors which are perpendicular to this observer, right? Because you have a space-time metric. And now in those perpendicular directions, you shoot space-time geodesics. And at least locally, they form your spatial manifold, which you then on which you construct your canonical theory. So this I'm not sure whether there will be really such a drastic change from the covariant picture to from let's say covariant formulation of the canonical theory. Now another answer is that in the context of ADS-CFT, people are using there is. Okay, so they are using different approaches, and some of them are more covariant, and the furthest they can go is the first perturbative order. So they consider weak fields, and then and they do it perturbatively. I haven't seen any results in the full theory, and I also didn't obtain them myself.
No, but I think that thank you. So, but I think that if you look at the full covariant space, the constraint algebra structure is different, right? Because there the synthetic structure is actually degenerate from the beginning. And if I look at the kind of the diffeomorphism group, I mean, in this case, you get structured functions, right, in a canonical picture. The covariant picture, you just get the full diffeomorphism group. So there's no four-dimensional diffeomorphism group. So there are no structure functions there. And therefore, I think that things are significantly different. Now, what you're saying is that nonetheless, there is a natural reduction given by the radial gauge from the covariant phase space to the canonical phase space. And I agree with that. And that might simplify something, but to me, at least, it's not transparent and it might be worth looking at. I mean, if it's something that looks very hard, it's not worth pursuing, but if it looks like because of this extra structure you get in the radial gauge, the covariant phase space is controllable, that would be very helpful to look at. Okay, my last question, very quickly. This might not know the answer, but please let me, just in case you know the answer. So if I look at your conclusion, right, and your conclusion that even in the matter sector, you don't have this ultra-locality, the fields don't, the matter fields don't commute at space-like separation. Mm-hmm. Now you mentioned something about perturbation of the method, namely if I just do perturbation, switch off gravity and just do a first order perturbation, so to say. And maybe at first, you know, those fields would commute with each other. But on the other hand, as soon as you bring in gravity, right, I mean, to the next order, then they will not commute with each other. Now, is there any discussion in the area of CST literature about tension, therefore, arising from using the radial gauge of the Pepperman chart and the general philosophy, right? Because if I were to do quantization in the bulk in a non-perturbative way, I would still think I got this micro-locality, that these off-field operators would commute at space-like separations. And now you're coming from the CST side, that is to say you're integrating things from the boundary inside. Your conclusion is that if I kept in not just the fields by on a non-gravity background, but if I include the gravitational, if I include terms of kappa in the relation two that you've got, then in fact these fields don't commute. So isn't there a tension between the two ideas? And have people discussed the possibility of such tension?
So I think that it is a question important for this ADS CFT correspondence, and in some sense I would so to my understanding people try to address it, but the problem is that at least to my understanding, it's not that they want that they it's clear what exactly they want, so what they start from and where they want to get, right? So they're just investigating different ideas, and I think that conclusion is that there is a tension I'm not sure I will exactly answer your question, but I would say that there is this tension, because if you want to do it in this way, which is this Pfefferman-Graham or space-time radial gauge, then you want to propagate this information from the boundary to the bulk with this particular dictionary, which is given by the space-time radial gauge, and it turns out that the resulting fields are non-local; they are not interpretable in the standard local quantum field theory language, because the matter fields are not spatially are not commuting at space-like separations. So, in some sense, there is a tension, but to my understanding, what the strategy that they are employing is really like trying something and proposing something and seeing how it works. And then they're proposing on different parts. So, for example, you can propose some gauge, or you can propose some different way of constructing the operators in the CFT. And then you can see what works with what. And eventually you might get something. It seems to me that the conclusion is that in the space-time radial gauge, it won't be easy.
Yeah. So the question I asked was, specifically for the Graham Pepperman chart, which is very widely used in the whole literature. So let me just sort of sharpen it just for other people also, so that one can, other people may have ideas. I mean, this correspondence, you know, one does this, one has a number of fields, and then in large N expansion, one is supposed to recover supergravity, right? So the first approximation is supergravity, and then there are more non-perturbative corrections that come in. But already at the level of supergravity, there is micro-locality. And in supergravity, kappa is not equal to zero. So supergravity, kappa is there. And therefore, I believe that already at the appropriate leading order, there is a tension. If you use the Pepperman Graham gauge, then there is actually a tension between solving the theory in this particular gauge, starting from the constructing the theory in the bulk and then relating it to the theory that is obtained by integrating the boundary theory. So there is a tension, and the tension is just that in one case one will find that there is micro-locality, namely if you start the bulk and just use for gravity, there will be micro-locality, but if you start from the boundary theory, then as we have just heard, it does not seem to be a whole. But it's simply that at this level only there is a tension. Thank you very much again.
Thank you.
More questions?
I have a question. Can you hear me?
Not really.
Maybe I can try to. Okay, do you hear me now?
Yeah.
Yes, better.
Yeah, okay. Okay, you have said that, your analysis shows that there is a non-locality among the matter fields if these geometric gauge conditions do not commute among each other, right?
Yes.
So if we turn to the slide number 5, these gauge conditions are introduced in such a way that these space-time geodesic the radial lines are space-time geodesics. Right?
Yes.
So the connection coefficients must be zero. So is there any alternative gauge conditions are there any alternative gauge conditions which do commute among each other so that there is no non-locality?
Yes, there are such proposals. You can find a very similar conditions which are, however, which are commuting with each other. So this is also described in our paper. So basically this KRR can be interpreted as a conformal generator, and it has two parts which it splits into two parts which scale differently, and then you can adjust the scale in such a way that it commutes with the other fields, also somehow adjusting the other conditions. So it can be done, yes. But it won't have... So the advantage of such a different gauge fixing is that your gauge conditions will be mutually commuting. Therefore, at least the matter sector will have canonical algebra. But the problem is that you are not in the space-time radial gauge, and you're losing this interpretation. Which sometimes is a price you are willing to pay.
Okay, thank you.
Also, this gauge would not be the Seifermann-Graham gauge, right? In the
of course.
ADS context.
Okay, if there are no more questions, let's thank Yedri again.